This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, what are the implications of the case of Albert Shrum for Papua New Guinea's higher education sector? He's the former Vice Chancellor of Unitech who was sacked and arrested, and he claims what's happened to him shows the corruption that exists within the country's university sector and legal system.
There is absolutely no primary evidence that I have falsified anything. I was dismissed for no reason whatsoever. I was arrested for no reason whatsoever. And it's really quite sad for the university, but also the country.
And history is in the making with the first ever women's state of origin just a day away. So will PNG rugby fans jump on board? PNG Orchids player Amelia Cook reckons so.
I think coming from playing in the World Cup with the Orchids, they know who I am now. I think with that state of origin, it'll give them more of a reason to tune into women's footy and have a look.
We'll have more on that story coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. First though, Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister has used an emergency dash to the troubled Highlands region to call for calm and urge people there to show respect for the laws. But there are warnings the situation on the ground is still tense. Peter O'Neill headed to his home province of Southern Highlands yesterday, slightly delaying his scheduled trip to China after his government declared a state of emergency in the province following last week's rampage by supporters of a losing election candidate. Here's Bill Bainbridge with the details.
Peter O'Neill calls for calm and asks the people of Mendi to work together to restore order. He had been due to fly out to Beijing at 10 a.m, but that was put on hold to deal with the political crisis at home. But while his words may have had a calming effect, tensions on the ground remain high. Bill Hamblin is PNG's emergency controller.
People run amok and burn everything down and then they go back to their houses and quiet down for a few days. But it means it's still bubbling under the surface.
Anne Huago is the president of the Nipa Kutubu Women's Council. She says the tension is causing huge problems for the travelling public, especially pregnant mothers seeking medical assistance in other centres, including Port Moresby.
We women cannot always take the road. Well, it's time consuming. Sometimes the road is not accessible for women, especially when pregnant.
Bill Hamblin says the unrest has put aspects of the earthquake relief effort weeks behind schedule.
One of the warehouses was broken into with the aid of the security people who were supposed to look after it. They opened the doors and let people ransack the place. And there was another one near the airport where the disturbance took place. It was also looted. So we've lost a significant amount of supplies, which we've now got to replace. And we're doing a stock take to see exactly what was taken. But most of those things will be sold on the street out there because there's water and other goods and stuff taken. So people probably wouldn't be using them, they'll be selling them. On top of that, we've had about 100,000 kinas worth of vaccines destroyed, which were stored there for both Southern Highlands and Hela provinces. And at the moment, those vaccines would have catered for 25,400 children. And so all that's been lost. There's none available immediately in the country for replacement, so there's no contingency stock. UNICEF is using emergency funds to try and get replacements, and they're consulting with various suppliers to try and get into the country. So it's a major setback for maintenance of health and especially for young children in those two provinces.
So that must be incredibly frustrating to you and your team.
Well, it's frustrating that we have people with such a lack of any concept of law and order. They just run like a pack and destroy everything in sight. Just shows, you know, no common sense whatever and no consideration for their own children and those of the neighbouring province. They just don't care.
And how will you deliver that relief exercise now? Do you think that you will eventually be able to replace those or are they lost altogether?
Oh, well, they're lost, but we will replace them. We'll get new vaccines in, but it just sets back an immunisation program by, you know, a minimum of a month to 6 weeks. It also means that supplies that other people in the same province actually need won't be available immediately. We've got to get more supplies from Lane, get them sent up the Highlands Highway to Mendi, and then we're going to have to secure those on site. to make sure we can distribute them. So it means a lot more in terms of security costs.
That's Bill Hamblin. He's the PNG Emergency Controller, and he was speaking there with Bill Bainbridge. Well, Vanuatu's Prime Minister is expected to ask Australia to help finance a high-speed undersea internet cable that his government has connections to, after Canberra confirmed this week that it's footing an $130 million bill for a different cable for Solomon Islands and PNG. Australia stepped in as the majority financier of the 4,000-kilometre cable that will link the two Pacific countries with Sydney, and it did so after the Solomon Islands government had originally signed a cable contract with the Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei. But now, is that a deal that could threaten relations between Australia and Vanuatu?
The deployment of Vanuatu's first international submarine cable system linking Port Vila to Suva is the culmination of a five-year project by Interchange Limited and a massive milestone for the people of Vanuatu.
In the past few years, internet speeds in Vanuatu have become much faster with the construction of the ICN1, the country's first submarine internet cable, linking the capital, Port Vila, to a much bigger and faster fibre optic cable system via Fiji. But it was part of a much bigger plan by the internet provider Interchange Limited, a Vanuatu-based consortium.
But Interchange are already preparing for the next stage of the project, which will create a Melanesian communications hub, linking Vanuatu with the Solomon Islands, New Caledonia and PNG.
But those within Interchange say the waters are now a lot more murky for their plans because it's no longer the only player in the game.
Vocus's role is to project manage the construction of the submarine cable.
Michael Ackland is from the telecommunications company Vocus, this week announced as having won the $136 million contract to build an undersea internet cable paid for by the Australian government out of its aid budget.
And that will involve connectivity with Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands. At Solomon Islands, there's two parts of the project. There's the international system, but also a domestic system, and the construction of the submarine cables connecting back to Australia, as well as the four points in Solomon Islands.
The Australian government stepped in to help pay for the large infrastructure project amid security concerns because the Solomon Islands government had previously inked a deal with the Chinese company Huawei. And while it's been announced that Vocus will manage the project, just what company will build the cable is yet to be confirmed.
We've gone through a competitive tender process involving a number of global suppliers. We have yet to announce who our chosen supplier is there, but that will be announced in the coming days.
Does that have to be vetted by the Australian government? The sensitivities about a Chinese-owned company was what saw the Australian government step in to begin with?
Well, the Australian government certainly had oversight of the tender process. We have conducted that, but we've made our own choices in that regard.
But the ABC understands the Vanuatu private company, Interchange Limited, has for some months been raising concerns that it wasn't being considered for the job. The Australian government used a limited tender process to award both the scoping study for the cable and the project management, both to Vocus. And now, because Interchange has decided to push ahead with plans to build its own separate cable from Vanuatu to Solomon Islands, the ICN2, it's warning the Australian government's intervention into the sector will hurt it as a private company that's majority owned by the people of Vanuatu and the government.
I was a bit disappointed.
Jotham Nupert is Vanuatu's infrastructure minister.
I'm not objecting the support from the Australian government towards the government of the Solomon Islands. It's just that, you know, the support that, you know, the Australian government is providing to the Solomon government, they have to do the same for Vanuatu.
The Vanuatu Prime Minister, Charlotte Salwai, will be in Australia this weekend for his first visit as leader. And Minister Nupert says the PM won't be afraid to ask for Australia's help.
He's a shareholder. I'm also a shareholder. I'm representing the Vanuatu Post. He's representing the Vanuatu government. There's a joint meeting that I will be accompanying the Prime Minister, and definitely is going to raise this with his counterpart.
That's Vanuatu's Infrastructure Minister Jotham Nupert ending that report, and there will be a longer version available on our website.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, the former Vice-Chancellor of a Papua New Guinea university says his health, finances and reputation have been ruined by the wrongful dismissal and subsequent arrest by PNG police. Albert Shrum left PNG on bail and hasn't returned to face a recent court hearing on a charge of benefiting from a false pretense. The Council of the PNG University of Technology, Unitech, dismissed him for not being able to provide an original copy of his doctorate. But Dr. Shrum says his sacking and arrest shows the corruption in PNG's university sector and legal system, as our PNG correspondent Eric Dworchek reports.
PNG's three public universities routinely look overseas to find many of their staff, but now there are doubts about their ability to recruit foreign academics in the future, following the sacking and subsequent arrest of Albert Shrum for allegedly falsifying his qualifications. Their claims he strongly denies.
There is absolutely no primary evidence that I have falsified anything. So I was dismissed for no reason whatsoever. I was arrested for no reason whatsoever. And it's really quite sad for the university, but also the country.
A Dutch citizen, Dr. Shrum is the former Vice-Chancellor of PNG's University of Technology, or Unitech. He joined the university in 2012, but soon after, concerns were raised about the authenticity of his doctorate in economic history from the European University Institute. But he insists he was victimised for trying to clean up bad financial management, illegal allowances to senior staff, and make the university compliant with requirements for technical graduates.
You know, this happened to me because of wanting to change things.
6 years ago, a criminal complaint over the matter was filed by a former senior academic at Unitech, who is now a prominent lawyer in PNG. It was followed by a commission of inquiry into Dr. Shram's appointment, which found no evidence he'd lied and led to his reinstatement. But the council maintained Dr. Shrum needed to provide the original copy of his doctorate, and after a lengthy dispute and a settlement, Albert Shram's employment was terminated again in February. He left the country, returning for a short visit, and to his great surprise, was arrested by police who took his passport.
So I was basically held hostage against my will by the police, and they took about a week to finally charge me for this so-called false pretense.
The arrest was in connection to the criminal complaint laid in 2012, but it's not clear why police decided to act 6 years after the initial complaint and after Albert Shrum had been reinstated and dismissed again. Even the most basic search of the European University Institute's website reveals the academic has a doctorate, conferred in 1994. His thesis was also published as a book in 1997 by Cambridge University Press. Meanwhile, the Unitech University Council took out a newspaper advertisement denying responsibility for the arrest. Council member Sir Nagora Bogan says the body also asked police to let Dr. Shrum go.
What has happened in Moresby was not the doing of the University Council. We don't know who has initiated that. We have some idea about the people involved, but the motivation to do it, we are not too sure, and we tried to intercede.
A former Unitech Chancellor himself, Sir Nagora insists the dispute over Albert Shram's doctorate was not the main reason he was sacked. He claims Dr. Shrum angered the council by taking excessive overseas travel, failing to follow due process for the awarding of contracts, and not complying with council directives.
Those fundamental management breaches and also breach of his own contract in relation to entitlements on leave and travel has been quite substantive and material.
Dr. Shrum also denies those allegations. The academic was eventually given bail after a judge found police had made no effort to secure evidence against him. He was then allowed to leave PNG and return to his home in Italy. He told the ABC his doctor advised him not to return for the court hearing and his case was adjourned until September. Dr. Shrum says the dismissal and arrest have affected his health and his finances, and he remains deeply disappointed in the actions of the council.
I love the people of Papua New Guinea. They're so warm and welcoming and generous. So the behavior of the university council is quite the opposite of that. It's been very painful for me and my wife.
That's Dr. Albert Shrum, is the former Vice-Chancellor of PNG's Unitech, and ending that report from our PNG correspondent, Eric Dworchek. The Vanuatu government's move to set up a national youth authority, which is the first of its kind in the Pacific, has been described as a groundbreaker and one that will give its younger generation a seat at the table. After pressuring Parliament for more than 2 years, young leaders there can now influence the government's decision-making directly and have greater control over the country's youth development programs. Those who helped draft the bill for the new youth authority say will also act as a watchdog on the government to make sure that its youth-focused policies are effective. So could other Pacific countries follow suit? As Bindi Bryce reports, it's certainly a development that's already struck a chord in neighbouring Solomon Islands, where unemployment, substance abuse and limited education opportunities are barriers for young people.
Solomon Islands is a young country. More than half of its people are under the age of 30. There's no shortage of competition in the capital for study and work opportunities. And the president of the Honiara Youth Council, Harry James Olikwalafa, who's a former Commonwealth Youth Ambassador, says being a young person in Solomon Islands today is not easy.
It's about the family support structure. So now you can see young people left alone and wondering where can they, you know, engage positively. The modernization, like we're going to, like living in urban centres and stuff, we don't have the communal kind of support now.
Drug and alcohol abuse, crime and antisocial behaviour among the young is an ongoing problem in the Solomons. Harry James says that kind of behaviour can be the result of many factors, but he points in particular to what he says are flaws in the Solomons education system.
For you to get an education in Solomon Island is quite expensive now. And we don't have a safe net. The government doesn't create a safe net that young people dropped out from education can engage and continue, build their potential. There is no safe net for us, and there is a limited vocational school provide for that.
The Minister for Women, Youth, Children and Family Affairs, Frida Tuki, says the government is very conscious of the need to deal with concerns over youth disaffection.
My ministry and the Ministry of Police, we are really working hard on that. For me, as a leader of my own constituency, I really also support the young youths where they get married. I also support them to make sure that they have something to support their family, to make sure that they go into a small business.
But Youth Council President Harry James believes that the Solomons government is yet to make a strong commitment to its young people. He says leaders should look to neighbours Vanuatu and their plan to create a national youth authority that will have a thorough oversight of the government's youth development programs.
It's a good thing that I see Vanuatu moving forward in terms of finding some legislation to support the youth development in their country. We have a national youth congress established by the white paper in Parliament, but it doesn't give tooth to bite in terms of their function as watchdog or resource mobilisation.
As Solomon Islanders build their presence on social media, scepticism and disillusionment about politics is hard to ignore. The United Nations Development Programme has surveyed more than 2,500 people on what they see as the major challenges for sustaining peace and stability. And Country Director Azuzo Kubota says there was a common answer.
Many people said that corruption needs to be addressed so that resources would be used in an efficient way. A lot of young people also asked questions about, so what is the new anti-corruption bill coming up? What is in it? What can we do as young people to create a society and an environment where corruption will be difficult?
The coming months will be important for young Solomon Islanders, with Parliament due to debate stronger laws on corruption and review its policies on youth development at the next sitting in July. And then next year, there will be a general election.
It's Bindi Bryce reporting. Well, Australians overwhelmingly agree that they should be doing what they can to help out their nearest neighbour, Papua New Guinea. That's the finding of an annual poll by the independent think tank, the Lowy Institute. 77% of those people surveyed agreed with the proposition that Australia has a moral obligation to help Papua New Guinea. Bill Bainbridge spoke to the Lowy's Director of Research, Alex Oliver, about the poll and its findings.
On Papua New Guinea, Australians are a little bit concerned, I think. They feel that they have a moral obligation to help Papua New Guinea. There's 77%, so more than three quarters think that Australia has an obligation to help PNG, and that's probably a legacy of our sort of colonial history. Most also agree that stability in PNG is important to Australia as our, you know, nearest Pacific neighbour and a very large and important country to us. The relationship between Australia and Papua New Guinea does seem to have been damaged by the Manus Island detention centre issue and the controversies around that. The majority say that the relationship has been damaged before that. And Australians are not too certain about PNG's economic future. But around a third say that it has strong economic prospects. The majority disagree with that. So there's a level of uncertainty and perhaps concern about the trajectory of Papua New Guinea, either socially, economically or politically, but a strong sense of obligation and that it's an important relationship for Australia.
And what do you think's behind that? Like, what are the things that are informing people's view at the moment?
I think there's been a fair bit of coverage, you know, assisted by the excellent coverage of the ABC, of course, which is one of the few news organisations that has any presence in the Pacific and where we get the majority of our news, about violence in Papua New Guinea, about political change and upheaval, about corruption in the Papua New Guinean government, and about PNG's economic travails. So I suspect Australians are picking up on that, and they, you know, they're reasonably well informed, the average Australian, in fact. We're often surprised by the nuance which they bring to this survey and how they're able to answer these specific questions. They're not afraid to say when they don't know. For example, when asking about PNG's economic trajectory, 20% of Australians said that they didn't know enough to answer that question. But when they do know enough, they're happy to answer it. So I think Australians do inform themselves, and they're informing themselves by the sorts of news, a lot of which is negative, coming out of Papua New Guinea.
That's Alex Oliver. She's the Director of Research at the Lowy Institute, speaking there with Bill Bainbridge. Well, another chapter in the history of women's sport in Australia is about to be written, with the first ever women's State of Origin match to be played in Sydney on Friday night. And as Richard Ewart reports, that kind of recognition has been a long time coming, and two players with strong Pacific Island connections have each had a key role in the process.
Don't miss the Women's Interstate Challenge as the best New South Wales and Queensland female players put it all on the line for their state. Get your tickets today.
That was then, but this is now. After 19 years of contest between Queensland and New South Wales, labelled as interstate challenges, the women's game has been granted origin status at last. And for the New South Wales captain and long-time campaigner Ruan Sims, it's a moment to savour.
It really is. It's so exciting. And to have the accolade of that title being applied to the game is a massive step forward for us, because, you know, it gives young girls watching the game something to aspire to.
The first woman to earn a professional contract in Australia, Sims has Fijian heritage, while in the Queensland ranks, Amelia Cook is one of the players flying the flag for Papua New Guinea.
I think with everything happening in women's footy right now, it couldn't have come at a better time, you know, with the NRL comp at the end of the year taking off and with the Jillaroos winning the World Cup last year. I think it set a really good platform for women's footy, and it's a big stepping stone, and the future's looking really bright for the game.
And as well as the kudos of origin, Friday night's game at North Sydney Oval will get unprecedented live television coverage.
We are on free-to-air TV in a prime-time slot as well, and that is incredible. And Channel 9 are going to have some pretty big names commentating the game. So that, to me, really shows the level that the game has come to. And I'm just so glad that we can be a part of it. And it's happening in my playing career. I never thought I would see it.
And back in origin-loving PNG, Amelia Cook says she expects more and more rugby league fans to jump on board with the women's game.
I think coming from playing in the World Cup with the Orchids, they know who I am now. I think with that State of Origin, it'll give them more of a reason to tune into women's footy and have a look.
Ruan Sims has been very much at the forefront of the battle for origin recognition, and she says the changes she's witnessing now are not just cosmetic.
The biggest thing that I love about this is the language has changed around it, and we're actually becoming part of the rugby league landscape, and that shows that people are actually interested in our game. They're watching it, they love the way it's being played and the passion that we play with, and the continued support from New South Wales Rugby League, from the QRL, from the CRL and from the NRL will ensure that it's a sustainable product.
And Amelia Cook says the day when a woman can make a full-time career out of rugby league is very close.
Yeah, because girls are getting signed off now with NRL teams coming in, giving out contracts. We thought that this NRL comp was, you know, a few years away, but to get to the point where women are getting paid full-time to play the sport that they love is just around the corner, and as early as next year, I reckon.
But amidst all the excitement, there's also disappointment for Ruan Sims, who, after all her hard work as a campaigner for equality in women's sport, will miss out on the historic first Origin match after breaking her hand.
It is disappointing, but I'll be there watching the game and still be part of history in my own little way.
It's a shame it wasn't a three-match series this time.
I definitely would have been back for two or three. So, you know, maybe that might become a little pet project of mine for the future.
But for this year at least, the Origin contest will be a one-off, with New South Wales perhaps the marginal favourites after winning the Interstate Challenge for the last 2 years. But only after Queensland dominated for the first 17 years, going undefeated from 1999 right through to 2015.
That's Richard Hewitt reporting there. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat for this morning. But don't forget, you can hear us again this afternoon from 3 p.m. PNG time. And I will be back again same time tomorrow, starting at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning at PNG time. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for your company. You have a great day.